Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we focus on a bit on birds. There are some beautiful birds that exist out there, and you might imagine that you need to visit exotic places to see so many of them, but our guest says not necessarily. John Marsluff is the author of a new book. It's called Welcome to Suburbia, Sharing Our Neighborhoods with Wrens, Robins, Woodpeckers, and Other Wildlife. And he's going to share the birds that have adapted to our suburban wildlife, which makes wonderful bird watching right in your backyard, and also talks about how we can maybe improve that situation for our birds. John's a professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington and is the author or co-author of more than 130 scientific papers and 5 books, and certainly a renowned ornithologist and urban ecologist. And John, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
I think the story of kind of how you got interested in this is interesting. Talk about how'd you sort of hit on this topic?
Well, when I moved to Seattle about 20 years ago now, I was struck by the development that was occurring around here. Lots of our native forests, second growth, but still nice native stands of trees were being cut down and transformed into nice exurban and suburban subdivisions. So I was curious how the heck the birds responded to that, and it kind of took me back to when I was a kid, and a similar thing had happened in the neighborhood where I used to enjoy playing in the nearby forest, and that was converted to a subdivision, and I was concerned about deer and things like that back there in the Midwest.
Well, it's really, you've come up with some fairly surprising results about the species that have adapted to our environment in order to survive.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it surprised me as a conservation biologist to go out and survey birds, for example, from the heart of the city through the suburbs and into the kind of wilder spaces here around around Seattle. And what we found was that diversity of birds, the number of different types of species, that didn't just increase as you got into wilder and more woody places, but instead it actually peaked in the suburbs, and that's where the greatest richness of birds was found.
And why the suburbs?
Well, I think when you go back and look at the kinds of different settings that occur in our suburbs, as long as they're not too densely settled, they include a great mix of habitats that a lot of different birds utilize. So you have some parks and forest remnants. You've got some open areas. You've got retention ponds for runoff and lots of different settings. And each of those holds a somewhat different set of birds. And in comparison, in the heart of the city, it's more uniformly developed, or in the wildlands, it's more uniformly forested. And so you get a decline in diversity of birds in those more simple conditions.
That was kind of interesting. And I forget where in the book, but you talk about going to Yellowstone Park, and then this is kind of on a related issue, going to Yellowstone and then traveling to New York City.
Yeah, I take a class to Yellowstone every spring break to look at birds and mammals there, and you know, we count 20 or 25 species of birds typically on a week there. And then I happened to, one of those years, turn right around the next few days and went to Central Park and counted even more bird species there. So two kind of signature parks in North America, very different sorts, had about the same number of birds.
What adaptations have you seen in that birds in the suburbs have developed for their success?
Well, I think fundamentally the birds that are able to live with us, and I think it's important to realize that they don't all live with us very well. There's a lot of birds that avoid being close to us, and those are ones that typically are either stressed out by just our presence or our noise and activity, or they require very specialized habitat resources, typically native conditions, whether it's prairie up where you guys are at or whether it's deciduous forest. But those that live with us, they are more tolerant of our actions. They are quick to adapt to the things we put out there, like food or novel nesting places or novel sorts of plants that we put in the environment. And those birds that are able to adapt to those are the ones that really survive with us.
So those, and you talked about avoiders earlier there, and you talk about adapters in this in your last answer. And there's exploiters as well, and you discuss in your book.
Yeah, these three groups of birds, a friend of mine, Dr. Rob Blair at University of Minnesota, came up with these terms to describe three functional kind of groups of birds and how they respond to us. And as their names imply, some of them increase, some of them exploit, some of them decrease in our presence.
Talking today with John Marsliff, who is the author of Suburdia, Welcome to Suburdia, Sharing Our Neighborhoods with Wrens, Robins, Woodpeckers, and Other Wildlife. Cool book, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions about the maybe birds that you've noticed in your urban home, experiences you've had along the lines of our discussion today, unusual species that may inhabit your areas. Love to hear about it. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show. I'd certainly love to hear from you. Is there a point where urbanization becomes so urbanized, I guess, that birds can't thrive?
Well, there is certainly a point where it limits the types that can survive with us. But, you know, it's surprising. If you look around the world, and many ecologists are now focusing on life in the city because that's where most people live, and it's relevant for us to consider, you know, how we shape that system. But when you look even in the heart of the city, like London or New York, there's still an incredible diversity of birds, but it's certainly lower than if you go to a place that has a greater mix of some natural and some built landscapes. But it's not devoid of life by any means.
And as you point out, I think at some point you cite some studies of the diversity of plant life that may exist in these areas that are really quite surprising, the vast array.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing when you think about all the sorts of plants we've brought into our places that we like to live. And in Seattle, for example, there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 600 species of trees in the metropolitan area. Now, that's less than a tropical rainforest, but it's not all that much less, and it's a order of magnitude higher than you would get in our native forests that live around here. So
yeah,
that increase in the sorts of plants that live around us is incredible, and a lot of animals take advantage of it.
Again, you can join in with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Let's turn to Jeff in Brookfield, who has a question. Jeff, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
We have a situation where robins will dive bomb our windows, I mean, hundreds of times. I know it could be a reflection, but is there anything else on that? Or have you ever heard that when that happens, someone's supposed to die?
I haven't heard about the omen associated with that, but it's certainly a very common thing. And what the bird is doing is responding to its reflection, as you said, seeing it as a challenger in its territory and trying to fight it off. But shoot, every time it gets there to chase it off, that guy comes right back at him. So it just eggs on that aggressive display. And unfortunately, really the only thing you can do is make that reflection go away. You can cover up the window or somehow obscure it with mylar flagging and things around it that will keep the bird away from it. But once one of those territorial guys figures out that he's got a rival over there, it's hard to sway him, that's for sure.
Yeah, there are some, I think there are some now, not curtains, but there are some types of curtains, I guess, that you can see through, but that will also sort of take away that effect on windows, or at least that's how they're advertised.
It makes sense. You could have some sort of ultraviolet reflective film or curtain that the bird would basically not see it as a reflective surface because they see in ultraviolet, they'd see it as more of a solid surface, and yet it doesn't interfere with our vision much at all.
John Marsliff, our guest today, having fun talking with him about his book, Welcome to Suburbia, Sharing Our Neighborhood with Wrens, Robins, Woodpeckers, and Other Wildlife. And John, I suspect one of the reasons for writing this book is to talk about, actually inform us about the situation with our bird life, but also offer up some ideas about how we can make things better.
Yeah, absolutely, Larry. And there, I think there's a lot we can do. Again, keeping in mind that our land harbors a diverse community of birds, and how can we sustain that in the future as other lands around us are changing rapidly? You can do a couple of things. The window treatment that we just mentioned, that's the second leading source of mortality in birds, is their collision with windows, not fighting it, but flying blindly into them. And the typical house kills two or three birds a year in the United States, and when you total that up, it's a half a billion birds that are killed by window collisions. And making those more visible through screens or netting on the outside or reflective stickers that don't interfere with our vision much is an easy way for everybody really to contribute to reduce that source of mortality.
Yeah, and you actually have 9 or 10 things in your book that. And we'll get to those things, I think, as we move along here, that we can all do, really, to help improve our situation. Jan in Waukesha County has a question. Jan, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. In suburban environments where you have a neighbor here and there, probably more often than not, but I don't, who sprays their yard with herbicides and pesticides, does the lawn service come like every 3-4 weeks? I would think that is contributing to a degradation of the groundwater, and we are on private wells, so I don't really want my groundwater affected. And I would think that it impacts the wildlife as well. And I think that there also should be a buffer of 15 to 25 feet between lot lines so that they can't spray in it, and if it's a windy day, it goes in your property.
John, a comment. Thanks for calling, Jan.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, that's actually my first rule of things we can do to help birds is to reduce the amount of lawn we have. And that would go along with reducing the spraying and tending of that lawn. It's amazing the sorts of resources we put into lawn maintenance, the pollutants that are there for insect or herbicidal control are certainly detrimental to the system, as you mentioned, Jen. And reducing lawn cover and in its place, having shrubbery or trees helps offset more carbon. It helps provide habitat for a lot of the birds that will live around us. And it's a win-win situation because it also causes us to spend less time tending the lawn or less money making this beautiful lawn to our eyes, which really isn't very beautiful to anybody else's eyes.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling, Jan. And you actually talk about carbon sequestering. You did some research on your own family situation, and I think you had some surprising results in terms of the amount of the carbon sink that a tree performs.
Yeah, it's impressive. I have to commute into town. I can take a bus most of the time, but I'm about 25 miles away from the university. And so I was always concerned about, you know, the cost of doing that carbon-wise. And I have a 2-acre parcel, and 1 acre is all in about 70 to 80-year-old trees. And I just calculated based upon the average size and the growth of those trees annually how much carbon they put on. And it more than offsets my family, my two daughters, and my wife and I's consumption and release of carbon from our typical commuting and heating and traveling sorts of budgets. So to me, I was quite surprised at that. I thought, geez, you know, I'm a conservation biologist, and I'm not really, living the way I should here. But I was glad to find out that by setting aside a bit of a carbon source and sponge like that, you can make up for a lot of things. And actually heard on the radio driving in today that one of our corporate neighbors here, Microsoft, has done a similar thing, putting aside a large amount of forest on next to one of our national parks to help offset some of the costs of their carbon usage as well.
John Marslov, our guest today, as we talk with him about his book, Welcome to Suburbia, Sharing Our Neighborhoods with Wrens, Robins, Woodpeckers, and Other Wildlife. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A little bit later on in the program today, we'll be talking with David Alexander, who has authored a book titled On the Wing, Insects to Pterosaurs, Birds, Bats, and the Evolution of Animal Flight. Interesting topic. I'm looking forward to talking with David, but having fun right now talking with John Marslov, a professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington. And he has authored a number of books, including the one we're talking about, Welcome to Suburbia, Sharing Our Neighborhoods with Wrens, Robins, Woodpeckers, and Other Wildlife. If you go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, we've got a link to the book and to John. So I hope you'll go there as we move along and talk with him. You may have a question or comment or maybe an experience to share. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. You know, here in Wisconsin, John, and pretty much across the state, but as particularly in southern Wisconsin, wild turkeys have there are several wild turkeys on my lot. I live right in town. Mm-hmm. They don't stay there all the time, but they wander through. Then Jim posted a photo from the Linden Sculpture Garden. A flock of turkeys, one of them disturbing a great blue heron, also in that garden. So sometimes there's surprising how some birds can really adapt.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to mention the wild turkey is a classic example of an adapter species right now. It was virtually unheard of through much of the Midwest when I was a kid growing up there. And as you say, now it's a regular feature of urban and suburban settings. And this animal has just thrived in areas where hunting is not done very often and where oak trees and other nut crops that we've planted in our cities have thrived and provided a great resource for them. So it's a remarkable story, really, one of the birds people were concerned about with not really that long ago, but now maybe concerned even for another reason. They're big and boisterous in your lot, yeah.
And the aside to that is we thought, well, we can get them established in southern and maybe central Wisconsin, but that's it. And as far north as you can go in the state of Wisconsin, you'll find turkeys. It's just absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Melanie in Star Prairie has a comment. Melanie, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I heard you just talk about grass turf, but I'm just wondering if our guest could elaborate a little bit more out in the rural area where I live. I really see so much turf grass, and I heard an analogy recently that turf grass is like a desert for wildlife. And I think people maybe need some more ideas and encouragement and help on what they can concretely do to replace turf, and that it is, you know, species that we can use to replace and all the things that are attracted to those. And just it really, I see it even, like I said, out in the rural area, just too much turf and very sad.
Thanks for calling, Melanie. John?
I definitely agree. It's a desert. There are very few animals, if any, that carry out their full life function in a turf setting like this. I think the way to start it, and it's hard to give an absolute answer because it depends on where you live, but the first thing is to look in what was the native habitat there. If you're in a prairie situation, replacing that turf grass with some native prairie grasses, or at least a variety of heights of grasses that would occur there, that would provide habitat for the sorts of species that are going to be perhaps in more of the reserves there, but could come in and utilize our built and living space if we provide some of the needs that they have. So that would be my first guess, would be try to do some perennial native grasses. You still have a low stature sort of landscaping that some people like, but then spruce that up with some trees as well. Again, that adds structural height diversity, we call it, so that some birds that use trees and some that use the ground level could both occur there. In a turf setting, you really don't have that mix. And then native shrubs are really the best thing that you can do around your property as well. They add buffers for dirt and dust, as well as even some of the herbicides and things from elsewhere. They help to cleanse the air basically coming into your living space. So that combination, think of it as making three-dimensional habitat, if that's what was natural there. Some overstory trees, some shrubs, and some native ground cover would be great. If it's a two-dimensional landscape that was natural there, a prairie setting, keep it like that. Introducing the third dimension of trees and things, while we like it, can be a hindrance to some of the birds that need that open space. Things like meadowlarks, which have been declining, they drop out when we tend to take a prairie area and turn it into more of a savanna or a forested setting. So you have to keep in mind what the natural setting was. Try to emulate that structurally, at least, if not with the actual species. And that would help a ton relative to the turf desert.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, Melanie. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. Tom in Madison has a comment. Hi, Tom.
Hello. I just wanted to make the comment, hearing the comment about turf grass. You had a guest on some years ago, and I always remember this, saying that the amount of oxygen that turf grass creates, and they were talking about, especially at night, I guess, and it made me think, well, maybe that's why people have lawns. That person was talking about the health benefits of grass around a house. It was really quite astonishing to me that he was saying that it's far more productive is a lawn than trees in that regard. Anyway, I have a lawn.
Okay. Well, John, I'm trying to remember that show, and it must have been a long time back, because I don't have a recollection of it, but what about grass versus trees?
Well, it's not surprising, maybe, from the photosynthetic angle, and that's what we're talking about here, is emitting oxygen and taking up carbon dioxide to basically make plant matter. And grass grows fast. It's all photosynthetic. That it's all green. And trees, some of the part of the tree isn't. But what you don't see is what's going on in the soil as well. And the soil under turf grass is not productive. It doesn't take in carbon dioxide and store it, and it doesn't emit oxygen like a forested setting does. So I think on the balance, if you look, at just the tree versus a blade of grass, you could make that argument, but not if you look at the whole system. And in addition, a more natural system does have a ground layer that is photosynthesizing and emitting oxygen. And so I think it's a bit of a false comparison. It's interesting to think about it, but, you know, the real reason we have lawns, it's in our history from our British ancestry, really, over here in the New World, and that is, it was a signature of wealth back in the day. If you had a big estate, you had a well-tended lawn, it was impressive to the serfs who didn't have that. And that's been the carryover here for us, really. It's a symbol of wealth and prosperity, and that's it.
I think you, it's been interesting, and thanks again, Tom, for calling. You were reporting on in cities, in areas of the city where cities that are not as prosperous. This is what reminded me of it when you made the comment about poor areas of cities. Actually, you'll find more bird life because there are more sort of brush and things that have developed that you wouldn't find in the wealthier areas.
Well, to some extent, you do. You find some interesting pockets, really, of quite diverse habitat. But in general, actually, more wealthy neighborhoods, and it's not because of the turf grass, but it's because of the other plantings they have.
Oh.
There's typically a correlation with wealth and bird diversity. There's even the inverse, and that is there are some situations where providing that sort of habitat increases the value of your house as well as the biological value to birds.
You talk about birds that some birds are able to adapt, others wind up running into problems or even really seriously declining. And you mentioned the house sparrow, the house sparrows are sort of ubiquitous. I thought it seemed like the everywhere you looked, you saw house sparrows, and you really that's not so much the case.
Yeah, I mean, house sparrows are one of the Fab Five, I call them. They're found everywhere, and they are abundant in some settings. But what's interesting is that if you go back to where they were native, which is in northern Europe, their abundance has been declining there because of increased predation by some sparrowhawks, aptly named, that have increased in abundance, and mainly because of reduction of that small farm grain sort of habitat that they really evolved in living with us. And by paving more in the cities, that's taken out some habitat, and by especially going to more industrial farming there as opposed to the small-scale rural setting where these animals were quite abundant, their numbers have declined. Now, they're healthy in some places in their non-native habitat, some of our cities, but we may have to rescue the native population at some point with those birds that ended up here.
A couple of email comments I wanted to get in. Email from Nora, who said, this goes back to our bird collision with windows. She says the bird tape from the American Bird Conservation Organization is quite useful in preventing birds from striking the windows. And she listed the website, which we can... Cheyenne, you want to put that up on our Facebook page? It's abcbirdtape.org. So abcbirdtape.org. So that's a place you can look if you want to get something for your windows. And Valerie commented in an email, just wanted to encourage everyone to appreciate crows. They're smart and entertaining. I know there's a little girl in Seattle who's gotten famous on YouTube because... her, in quotes, crows, have left her a bounty of presents, and they returned her mother's lens cap that she had dropped to her. She had dropped it, and the next day the crows brought it back. So I've gotten two presents from them, a triangular rock and a pile of feathers. They are fun, fun, fun.
Excellent. Yeah, one of my favorite birds for sure. In fact, kind of a sad note to that. I had an email from the mother who got the lens cap back just this morning, and her neighbors are not too happy with all the crows that come in and leave gifts for the kids and really instill this wonder of nature in those kids, and they basically got an injunction on them feeding these birds now. So it sets up another interesting aspect of this nature around us, and that is some people really appreciate it, and some people get a bit annoyed by it. Of course, when things get abundant and are successful, they can challenge us. And so learning to live and appreciate these sorts of animals that can be trying at times, whether they're crows or raccoons or coyotes, that takes some sacrifice on our behalf. And it's something that I hope that readers of the book would take away, and that is this wonder and appreciation for the diversity of life around us and trying to be patient with it and foster it where we can.
You know, before we go back to the phones and to other comments, I should have asked you this early on, but do you want to talk about how your book is organized and you know, what you hope from it?
Sure. I review some of the science that my colleagues and my students and I have done to understand this suburban ecosystem as we've discussed and why it's diverse, and then I go into a variety of things we can do to maintain that. And I don't limit it just to birds. Interesting to see how mammals and snakes and things respond as well. They don't do as well as birds typically because they can't fly, as you'll talk about next.
That's
great. And then I also talk about the evolution of birds in our neighborhoods. There's been some incredibly rapid, you know, several decade pace of evolution in our backyards, and appreciating that and understanding that, I think, is really fascinating. And then offer up these tips of things we can do, like reducing lawn and keeping your cat inside, and some of the things that the one email comment about the ABC pointed out there. The ABC is a great source for some of this sort of information as well.
Don in Warren, Illinois has a comment. Don, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, you just touched on it. The fact that people leave their cats out for great periods of time. We've known for many, many, many years that a well-fed cat still makes a terrible predator. They kill stuff and really don't need it. They just are born killers. And they take small birds and mammals without need. People need to keep their cats under control, like you've said.
Yeah, well, thank you for calling, Don. And John, I don't know if you know, Stan Temple was a professor of wildlife ecology here at the UW-Madison. Did some research on the number of birds that cats will consume, and it's staggering.
Yeah, Stan's a great researcher there. He's done awesome things for a long time. And one of the early studies on the effects of cats, that he did for sure. More recent compilations have shown that somewhere between 2 and 4 billion birds per year in the United States alone are killed by cats. And that's basically 1 in every 10 birds killed by a cat in the U.S. And it's in Australia and the U.K. and everywhere else as well. It's by far and away the number one mortality source for wild birds. And again, something that we can certainly do something about by keeping them inside where they live twice as long, cats twice as long as a wild cat, or on a leash or in a cattery, or using a variety of devices that might reduce their ability to catch birds. But even just being outside, even if they don't catch and kill a bird, they disturb nesting birds, and that leads to nest failure as well.
Absolutely right. I have two cats, and they get outside to visit the vet. And
that, good.
And that's it. Otherwise, Tiger and Coco spend their life, and they look out the window, and I've got bird feeders out there, and they love to watch the birds.
Yeah.
And that's just fine. Yes. I'm with you on that. What are some other, you know, we've talked about keeping the cats indoors, and lawns. We discussed lawns, and we've just talked about windows. What about lights? You talk about not lighting the night sky.
Yeah, I mean, night lights are a problem for lots of animals. They disrupt migration in birds, for example, or disorient them if they're red lights, where they'll increase their the crashing into high skyscrapers. And I know Wisconsin and other places have done a great job at having lights out programs during the migration season, where skyscrapers dim their lights or turn them off during the migration season. But even around our home, looking around and seeing if lights are pointed out, that tends to illuminate a larger area than is typically needed for our safety or whatever. And so looking at softer lights, downward-facing lights, all of that can help provide dark space, which a lot of animals need to carry out their daily life.
And there was another one that interested me as well, which you talk about, and it's creating a safe passage across roads and highways. What are you getting at there?
Yeah, absolutely. So birds don't have as much of a problem with that, of course, but some do, like the barn owl, are killed by cars quite often. But especially mammals and reptiles and amphibians, they need a way to get across our roadways. And there are certainly many ways to do that, little pipes between breeding ponds and upland wintering areas for salamanders work well. But some places, like in New Jersey, they had a great solution for a spotted salamander migration where they just shut down the roads at night in the neighborhood that had these animals crossing their roadways every autumn and spring would just have a block party and celebrate this migration and get out and enjoy it. And that's really kind of doing two things, bonding with nature around us, which is key, and also providing safe passage for it.
A Facebook comment from Judy who said, I recently had multiple viburnums planted on my property, and the birds love them. Most get berries, some for summer, and then the high bush cranberries stay all winter. And
yeah,
that just goes along with what you were talking about, John.
Exactly, and brings up, you know, one other thing you can really do, and that is provide food. And providing it on bushes, like we just heard, is great, but even bird feeders and bird houses for shelter, those are great augmentations to the yard that increase the ability of birds that live with us to live in large populations and evolve with us as well.
So we have, really had a lot of great things that we've talked about here today, John. I want to thank you so much. This whole business of functional connections between land and water, I just think that is another area that you talk about that is so key.
Yeah, and it's maybe more for the planner among us or the city council to think about these sorts of things. But I think in the upper Midwest and the West Coast, we do a great job of this. Our waterways we recognize as being so important for many aspects of our environment. And keeping vegetation along those so that the animals that utilize both, and that's always a rich area in our settings, but they need to travel along there. They need to move between aquatic and terrestrial worlds. And maintaining cover along those riverways and lake shores, that not only benefits water quality and scenery, but it benefits those animals as well.
And just to conclude, there are a couple of things I'm kind of proud of for the city in which I live, which is Madison, Wisconsin. But many cities across Wisconsin are now tree cities. We have a Tree City USA program, but we also have a Bird City USA program. And Madison is both a Tree City program and Bird City certified as well.
Fantastic. Well, I'm coming to Madison a little bit later in the spring, so I look forward to seeing that and seeing what kind of birds I can see there as well.
Oh, that'll be great, John. Let me know when you're coming. We'll have you come by and say hello.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, John. John Marsliff, a professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington, authored more than 130 papers and 5 books. His latest book is Welcome to Suburbia, Sharing Our Neighborhoods with Wrens, Robins, Woodpeckers, and Other Wildlife. And, of course, birds are winged animals. And our next guest is talking with us about his book. It's called On the Wing, All Those Different Kind of Animals That Have Wings. And David Alexander's put together an interesting book. We'll talk about that next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.